In my new model, heaven as a cosmological centre, like the Big Bang, is a true singularity with a specific location, even if unreachable. And satanic materialists would be rendered incoherent with rage as the false absolutism of their universe was unmasked. I planned an imagination experiment in personal transcendence, a shamanic ascension of the cosmic axis, and set off to New Zealand to attempt it, but was unable to obtain the necessary support, even though, as levity is important to me, I would have been happy if it had been treated by most people as a practical joke. Christchurch, New Zealand, a unique city founded by Christian romantics. On arrival in the city of Christchurch in 1974, I approached the city council, offering my services pro bono publico and requesting the transfer of my status as a living work of art on extended loan to the National Gallery of Victoria to the City Art Gallery. After being initially ignored, I was then rudely rebuffed, and this led to my declaring aesthetic war on the unaesthetically ignorant suits at the council. It was not until 1980 that I was acknowledged by the New Zealand Art Gallery Directors Council as the world's first legitimate living work of art, and issued with the world's first artistic license. Creating and launching the Imperial British Conservative Party into the general elections in Australia and New Zealand was a deliberate attempt to call upon established status to aestheticise the grubby world of modern politics, which was based on the alternatives of vulgar capitalist appeals to greed or puritanical socialist appeals to power. On aesthetic grounds alone, I must admit that fascist Italy and Nazi Germany were exceptions. Mussolini had the support of the futurists. The German totalitarian state was aestheticised by Dr. Goebbels, with his PhD in German Romanticism, supported by Hitler, who was an artist himself, and Himmler, obsessed with New Age occult symbolism. This probably accounts for their continuing negative attraction compared with the banal aesthetics of the equally murderous left-wing totalitarian states whose major symbol is the clenched fist or hammer. To aestheticise the ugly, politically motivated student mobs in the early 1970s, I created Aus Imperial Army, a performing arts group who declared war on friendly groups and fought battles on campuses. But unlike high-profile escapist team sports, which it superficially resembles, it is non-commercial and less formalised. The army is not like one of those commonly politically motivated mobs of the time, but an example of ritualised aggression, complete with weapons inspections, and is beautifully contextualised by building up tension through provocative ultimata and thunderous declarations of war expressed in biblical style. Unlike the bloody and ugly wars fought by the blob, Aus Imperial Army is non-violent and features colourful battle dress with pith helmets, rival regiments with different centres, campaigns throughout New Zealand, victory celebrations after battles held by both sides, and highly formal mess dinners in splendid uniforms at which specially struck medals are worn and the Queen is toasted. Reunions of old warriors and nurses and their loved ones are still being held after 40 years. To preserve my liminal aesthetic identity from being brutally deconstructed by the 5-yearly compulsory New Zealand census, I avoided filling in the schedules by transforming the inevitable conflict into genuine, not fake, living theatre in the real world. All the world's a stage. Dramatic scenarios that delighted the public were enacted when, in my role as a living work of art, I defied the authorities by going out to sea beyond the 12-mile limit, and during the next census when I cast a spell on myself to disappear for the critical few hours. This carefully planned political theatre by a social scientist defying repressive and pointless bean counting was not recognised as truly radical theatre in old-fashioned, self-promoting, avant-garde theatrical circles funded by government grants, with audiences buying tickets and sitting in theatres. These plays of mine, along with the successful telephone box war against telecom and my miraculously successful rain dances with no failures in both New Zealand and Australia, have become legendary in Oz, Australasia. The church authorities, the Anglican Church in Australia, did not reply to my 1973 letter requesting that they examine my credentials as an Anglican prophet, claiming I had received a call to speak on behalf of the people, felt that in their rush to be seen as politically correct, the gender-obsessed church had abandoned their Christian understanding of good and evil to avoid upsetting the humanist. My excellent training in the sociology of religion would enable me to avoid acting foolishly and bringing the church into disrepute with the traditional worshippers, as their own priests were doing. Arriving in Christchurch, I took up my position in the square in front of the Anglican Cathedral, dressed in an artificial camel skin costume resembling that of St. John the Baptist, as Hammer of the Heretics, with my plastic telephone receiver as my hotline to heaven. My initial task was to clear Cathedral Square from the gangs of self-righteous fundamentalists, informing modest Anglicans that along with Catholic nuns, they were going to hell. Nor was I tolerant with humanists, who believed that more and more compulsory secular education would make the world a better place. As the chief cashier of the Bank of Heaven, I issued heavenly credits for good deeds, as well as selling them for a dollar each, and then holding rituals outside the cathedral where I offered up Caesar's currency as a burnt offering. I designed, printed, and sold below cost a boxed, well-produced game called Salvation, based on the game Monopoly, where in place of the bank issuing dollars, the church issued heavenly credit. Instead of claiming dollars for rents, players earned these when the others landed on their good works. The council promptly prosecuted me for hawking without a license. Their lawyer, realizing that they were blinded by spite, since the games were produced and sold below cost, deliberately quietly let the prosecution lapse. This was definitely not hawking. The climax of my creative enterprise, relations with the council, had quickly improved once I'd used fun revolutionary tactics to persuade them to make an area in Cathedral Square into a free street zone, the only one in the centre of an Australasian city. I spoke most days from a ladder in front of the cathedral, like one of the old, now vanished breed of soapbox orators. Soon I was being featured as a major tourist attraction in all the overseas guidebooks. My acceptance as a genius Loki of Christchurch and New Zealand as a whole climaxed in 1990, the sesquicentennial year of the signing of the Treaty Waitangi, which brought the Maoris and British settlers together as one nation. The new Prime Minister, Mike Moore, and I had become friends while he was living in Christchurch, and he had been Minister of Tourism. He was seen by his party as a caretaker PM during his short term in office. He issued a proclamation appointing me Wizard of New Zealand. My duties included driving out evil spirits, encouraging small business enterprises, cooling off fanatical hotheads, and turning the world upside down to put New Zealand on top. He did this by fiat, since his rather bourgeois colleagues did not share his populist convictions as a working-class, self-educated man with a strong personal connections with Maoris and working-class Pākehās. He told me later that, like myself back in 1968, he had reached the effort point. Romance is not dead. In 1992, I decided to collaborate with the City Council in promoting their first Festival of Romance. My creation of a new romantic relationship based on animal studies and non-patriarchal hunter-gatherer social systems could be made into a performance, which completely reversed the usual polarity of sexual magnetism. Acquainted with Esther Vilar's radical treatise, The Manipulated Man, I was already notorious for my criticism of the way many mothers and wives manipulated their naive sons and husbands by using moral force. I gave my support to those independent, ambitious women who supported themselves, did not particularly want children, and who could afford to stay single or indulge their romantic passion for men they were not able to control. In this marriage form, like male animals and hunter-gatherers, the ego-tripping males are instinctively impelled to display as sometimes rather bizarre sex objects, and females then select them as their mates for similarly mysterious reasons. Some weeks before, I announced to a shock city that I'd been proposed to, and was considering whether or not I should accept. The announcement would be made by Vicky Buck, the mayor, at the opening of the festival. The speculation and the tension grew as I pondered my answer. It was yes, amidst cheers, my longtime partner, Alice. She was brought forward by the mayor to receive the ring, publicly aestheticizing this new form of relationship, not only delighted Ellis, but I also hoped it would encourage others. We are still engaged. I've been in the public eye as a role actor in Australia and New Zealand for almost 50 years, sometimes creating sensational and unprecedented events to avoid bureaucratic social control that would have destroyed my delicate cult identity, which is not legally enforced, but based on mutual trust. However, I'm astonished and deeply disappointed that until very recently, no thinker, not even a process thinker, has had their curiosity provoked enough to consider these unprecedented socio-cultural events significant enough to be worth studying. No one seemed interested in the complex reasons why I've chosen this sophisticated approach to cleanse the polluted stables of their decadent civilization. With a flood of cleverly designed laughter, I can understand that most academics, blinkered as they are by their reductionist and fragmented models of psychological, social, and cultural models of reality, will only be able to see me as a kind of harmless clown. The fact that this is the case is worthy of study in itself. Has compulsory education really destroyed native curiosity, as Einstein claimed? Was Shakespeare right when he wrote about the dangers of intellectual self-awareness? Thus, the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er by the pale cast of thought. And thus conscience doth make cowards of us all. Insisted by the local guardians of the blob, events are reaching a tipping point. For the first 25 years that I was in New Zealand, I appeared as a well-known weirdo celebrity at all sorts of social functions and was regularly invited to give humorous and thought-provoking talks at schools and clubs all over the country. For the past 25 years, although I have no criminal convictions or reputation as a troublemaker, I have been insisted like a dangerous virus and have been disappeared by all the institutions in New Zealand. And although famous both overseas and locally, I am no longer invited anywhere, and I am rarely mentioned officially. Many people believe that I must have retired and left Christchurch, even though I still appear in the city daily in my highly visible wizard's black gown and pointy hat, and spend much of my time in my role as the Limerick of Art, posing for locals and tourists and chatting to the rather like Socrates. I still receive my modest honorarium from the Christchurch City Council, granted many years ago as their Wizard in Residence, which is managed by my curator, Alice. This is before the Iron Curtain came down and my name removed from all city council and national publications, even those designed for tourists. I've been on friendly terms with elected representatives on the city council for many years, but during this time, the council administration has undergone a rapid increase in the numbers, status, and salaries of their certified managerial staff, who are obviously frightened of real people in the wild and rarely appear in the street. The elected councillors increasingly identify with the likable but fearful and impotent politician in Yes Minister, the perceptive BBC television comedy series. I can provide a metaphor of my artwork in progress. A Russian doll. The outer babushka is my easily seen acting out of the interrelated set of liminal roles of the university wizard aimed at provoking reflexive responses. But this doll contains a smaller babushka of the culturally validated role set liminally linked through trust to the educational, aesthetic, therapeutic and political institutions of our contemporary mechanistic civilization. Inside this is the babushka of the British constitutional monarchy. The government bodies who made my appointment derive their legitimation from the ancient non-mechanistic institution of the crown, which is sacred since it derives its legitimation from God and ancient tradition. But inside this babushka is the shaman, who is both healer and trickster and the world's oldest professional, who started mankind on its journey as an animal progressively evolving inside cultural containers. What happens next? here, like Prospero, in my self-chosen exile in a small island nation in the South Pacific. I've been watching unprecedented events like Brexit and the election of Trump unfold in the faraway world. I've been writing essays for some time in the hope that I'll eventually come across people who find my ideas and actions interesting enough to want to interact playfully with me. I believe that time is right to throw my hand to the ring, which is why I'm publishing The Blob and I. I would also like to take this opportunity to express my appreciation of the theoretical ideas and social experiments of Victor Turner on liminality and social anti-structures, whose work paralleled my own without either of us being aware of it. Meanwhile, I pay tribute to the blob-defying academic integrity of Roger Scruton in the UK and Jordan Peterson in Canada for not only standing up to the deluded left-wing student mobs trying to shut them down through physical intimidation, but for refusing to give in to the enormous pressure put on them by their academic colleagues and university administrators who have sold their souls to the blob. I await a call to join the last stand of those who value love, logic and levity enough to fight for them. I can bring a light heart, a vivid imagination, long experience as a performer, a powerful inside-out universe spell, and the enthusiastic backing of tens of thousands of sensible, unambitious hobbits of Christchurch. After half a century, the worst of times and the best of times has returned. Only a strong dose of laughter can purge the constipation our anally fixated global civilization is suffering from and cleanse the body politic from the accumulation of generations of poisonous excrement. Only then can we make a clear, unclouded assessment of what we must do to save the biosphere from imminent destruction. My title of wizard, which implies wisdom, trickery and personally responsible magic, helps protect me from being associated with both moral and rational absolutism. By combining love, logic and levity, independent activists can support themselves by entertaining the public. By doing this, they could take on a similar role to the prophets, bards and fools by using magic, music, poetry and laughter to lance the painful, poisonous boils which were once communities of scholars. The electronic media would greatly facilitate a worldwide fun revolution, revealing the absurdity of most academic claims to be objective and devoted to serving mankind. The spectre of fun is haunting academia and exposing fake learning. For 50 years now, the Conoscenti has been acting as professional elite, educating the masses and controlling the machinery of the state. They believe, like Scientologists, that they have a mission to organise themselves to rebel and take over the current world. Who can they rebel against? The answer to them has become those conservative people who are not suffering from resentment. Such people may not be rich or important or well-educated, but they're all disgusted by angry street mobs, public displays of sexual deviancy, repression of all non-left free speech in schools and universities, foul language and pornography-saturated mass media, collapsing families, unending attacks on Christian values of love and forgiveness, and the sexual manipulation of young children. It is these ordinary people that make up the current rising populist movement, so feared by those who put their jobs and their contracts with the movers and shakers of power-addicted globalism above all else. The British constitutional monarchy is the most important institution that remains mostly outside the blob, having been expelled from political power by the plutocratic enlightenment machine of government by the Whigs in the 18th century. Earlier, King Charles I had used divine right to justify overruling Parliament, who claimed the people's mandate. The result was civil war. Those with the divine mandate present themselves before the people. As Heidegger puts it, they present themselves as they are, rather than symbolically and frequently falsely representing others. This is true ritual enactment, not the use of theatre to disguise plutocracy. Royal weddings incarnate the archetypal mystical union of man and wife, and coronations incarnate the acquisition of legitimate authority. Both combine the magical beauty of true ritual with blessing by traditional religious authorities who are charged with the guardianship of ethics through prioritizing love over the satanic attraction of naked power. Immense joy is released on such occasions amongst general public who can identify with the participants. 2 billion people throughout the world watched the television broadcast of the recent British royal wedding, which maintained its traditional solemnity that included an American bride, a gospel choir, and an electrifying charismatic African-American preacher on the fiery power of love. Logic, love, and levity triumphed over the lies, hatred, and heavy seriousness of the blob. The ideological masters, the plutocratic blob, hate any idea of a divine, transcendental mandate of the political process. The mandate of God is no more mystical than the mandate of the people that the democratic governments and their armies of soulless bureaucrats in the blob claim. Turning one against the other is pure evil. Plutocrats use their global economic power to manipulate the reductionist, vote-based mandate of the people through control of the representatives in parliaments. They do this by means of lobbying, mass media support, and bribes in the form of donations to campaign funds to the undemocratic political parties under their authoritarian leaders who lie about fixing the perilous situation of the world. Their ideological stooges in the education institutions deliberately promote fanatical anti-religious political correctness while supporting and protecting murderous Islamic jihadists, putting the fear of Allah into peace-loving Christians. The blob is an evil entity that must be destroyed before it destroys us all, along with our biosphere. Who can be trusted to do this? A wizard and his colleagues and supporters drawing attention to the truth, which is that we are doomed without the intervention of the monarch and the British Commonwealth. She depicted her life to nurturing. Let us sing loudly together the second verse of our religious national anthem. O Lord our God, arise, scatter our enemies and make them fall. Confound their politics, frustrate their knavish tricks. On thee our hopes we fix, God save our Queen. This word spell was written during such events as Brexit, the election of Trump, and the hugely popular royal wedding, which were beginning to punch holes in the blob's overstretched skin. The self-loathing individuals trapped inside were beginning to become increasingly hysterical. Now that Trump is back in office with a loyal and talented team, the blob has been even more deeply penetrated. It is deflating, and as the hot air comes out of the holes being punched in it, there is an agonizing screaming sound.